Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke with Ross Reynolds. Hey, Ross.
How you doing, Bill?
Ross is here because at KUOW, we don't just talk, we listen. And Ross, you are executive producer with our community engagement team. And this summer, we're doing listening sessions. You, me, others, reporters, producers. We're going to 8 neighborhoods in the area. And we're asking what?
Well, we're asking about growth. We've got this theory that growth is kind of the overarching narrative of a lot of our news stories in the area. So that's a kind of a big narrative. And we're trying to break it down by going to neighborhoods in outlying areas outside Seattle and just asking folks, how is growth affecting you? Not the big picture, but how's it affecting your life day to day? We're also trying to figure out how we can become a better community service by just asking people, are there questions about growth or anything else that we might be able to answer for you? We have the privilege of our job is answering questions. Maybe they have some questions we can answer for them. And then thirdly, it's like, what else should we know about where you live? Things that we might not know because we don't spend a lot of time in Delridge or in SeaTac.
In fact, you and I will be in Delridge together in July 26th. So what have you been hearing so far? You've embarked on this listening tour.
Well, you know, a lot of things you'd expect to hear. We all know that growth is affecting traffic in horrible ways, and only a cursory look at the news shows how it's affecting real estate values and the cost of housing. Things are going up a lot. So it's affecting all those things, but they're playing out differently in people's lives.
How's that?
Well, we got a great example when we were down in Columbia City, and one woman kind of embodied this conflict. She said that real estate values are going up there a lot. Her family owns a piece of property, and real estate agents are coming around and dangling million-dollar offers before them to sell their place. Well, her brother's hot to trot. He thinks this is fantastic. $1 million. He sees the dollar signs.
Now's the time to
act. But she's kind of going to herself, well, where are we going to live? Fife? And I don't think she's a fan of Fife. So it's the whole thing is embodied in this one person, this conflict.
We're talking about this summer's KUOW listening tour with Ross Reynolds. Ross, what else surprising have you heard?
Well, we were in Bothell, and we heard several interesting stories about how it's affecting the natural environment. The mayor of Bothell was fondly recalling how they would capture coyotes back 40 years ago when he was a kid. That doesn't happen anymore. And in fact, a lot of the predators have been scared off. So they've got a rabbit infestation after you've been over to the Woodland Park Zoo. But oftentimes, there'll be so many rabbits there. And so that's apparently happening in Bothell. So both of those things may be a little bit bad for the area. But also, we heard that at the University of Washington Bothell, they've restored a salmon stream. So growth kind of affecting it in two different ways. And people are experiencing this divide between the benefits and the problems with growth in their own lives.
A divide in their lives? What do you mean by that?
Well, sometimes when we talk about growth, we think about the benefits of it and how it also causes problems. And sometimes those same things happen in one person's life. So when we were in Columbia City, I got a chance to speak to the Columbia City Business Association, which was really fun. And one woman came up afterwards and she said, you know, I live here and I'm a small business owner. I love the extra business. I love the fact more people come to Columbia City, so I'm selling more things. But I'm also someone who lives here, and I don't like the traffic. I don't like the fact it's hard to find a parking place sometimes. Then we talked to some people who had been running restaurants down there for some years, and they love the fact that they have more business. But two people individually both mentioned that, you know, we don't see our old customers anymore. The people who got us started, they don't come anymore because they can't find parking. So these stories kind of are together in single people's lives, and it's wonderful to hear them.
So we're learning about what growth means in people's lives. And what do we do with that information?
Well, some of these things will turn into news stories, and ideally they'll turn into some segments on this program where we'll be able to roll some of these stories out. We're searching for story ideas, individual story ideas, but also I think as the summer goes on and we go to all these 8 places, we're going to begin to see patterns where something happening in one place is also happening in another place. So we'll be able to just do more creative and overarching coverage of how growth is affecting us both positively and negatively.
Ross Reynolds, executive producer with our community engagement team. And can you give us the list of the neighborhoods we're going to be coming to this summer?
We're going to be in SeaTac. We're going to be in Kent. We're going to be in Delridge. We're going to be in Lake City and Kirkland. There's a whole list at our website at KUOW.org. Just search for the listening tour.
Ross, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Talking there about how we can learn more about how growth is affecting us. Here is a way we deal with growth in these parts. Of course, we decide how much mass transit we would like to pay for. Let's move to that now here on The Record. This fall, you are going to be asked to vote on a $54 billion package to expand light rail and bus service. It's called Sound Transit 3, and if it passes, it means big money for the construction industry. Yep. Turns out companies that have benefited from past Sound Transit contracts are some of the biggest donors to this ST3 campaign. KUOW's data reporter Abe Epton took a deep dive into the numbers, and he told Emily Fox what he found.
Something like 83% of the money that Sound Transit 3 has received so far come from organizations with financial connections to Sound Transit. That's contractors like Jacobs Engineering and HDR. It's labor unions. And they have an interest in passing Sound Transit 3 because it means that there are going to be more construction and infrastructure projects for them to work on. Some of these contracts reach into the tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars. And so their $50,000 check pales in comparison to the hundreds of millions of dollars that these companies get as part of these contracts.
So it seems like the more you donate, the more you get back.
Well, that's one way to look at it. And I think it's really important to stress that we don't actually have any evidence that those contracts were issued because of the contributions. All we have access to is the data in front of us, and that is who got contracts and who gave donations. And so we're looking at those two things. And I think it's important for people to draw their own conclusions. But this data is public, and I think it's important for people to know it.
So for this next Sound Transit proposal, ST3, what's an example of a company that's given money to ST3 and benefited in the past from contract work?
Sure. So one big one is Jacobs Engineering, which is an engineering firm based out of Pasadena, California. And they're currently building the East Link and Linwood Link portions of Sound Transit 2. They gave $50,000 to Mass Transit Now, which is the committee that's behind Sound Transit 3. And so that ties with the largest donation that Sound Transit 3 has received so far. They're part of a couple of joint ventures that together have gotten over $350 million in contracts from Sound Transit.
What do our campaign finance laws say about funding ballot initiatives?
Well, so the first thing that they say is that they don't actually say anything about funding ballot initiatives. There's nothing illegal and there are no limits to how much you can give to ballot initiatives. And so it's important to point out that these donations are perfectly above board and that there's nothing illegal about them. In contrast, if you're going to give a donation to an individual candidate, there are very hard limits. So $2,000 for some major individual candidate elections and $1,000 for other types of elections. So that contrasts with donations that easily go well above $10,000 in some cases.
You talked with a campaign that's backing Sound Transit 3. What did they have to say about all of this?
Sure. So they said a couple of things. We point out in the story that 83% of the money that Sound Transit 3 has received so far comes from companies that can be financially tied for substantial amounts over $1 million or $2 million to Sound Transit. They point out that 83% figure might be misleading because it includes a $50,000 contribution from Microsoft. Microsoft got about $2 million from Sound Transit as part of Sound Transit 2 to build a pedestrian bridge over 520. And the campaign points out that that's not really the same thing as a company like Jacobs Engineering, which does a lot of construction and contract work and is presumably going to be bidding for, these really large contracts. Microsoft isn't really in that same position. They also point out that the money that they've received so far is what they call seed money. It's really early money. It's still very early in the election, obviously, but they've been getting contributions since December. And so all we're doing is reporting what's been donated so far for the last 7 months or so.
Abe Epton is KUOW's data reporter. You heard him talking with Emily Fox there about ST3, the Sound Transit proposal. And you can find Abe's full story at KUOW.org. It's good to have you with us. I'm Bill Radke. This is KUOW's The Record. Miscarriage. You probably know what that word means. But for writer Angela Garbez, it's a problematic term. Angela wrote a piece about this for The Stranger, and she told me why there might be a better word.
So let's think about the term miscarriage. So think about other words that begin with the prefix miss. Mistake, misspell, misplace.
A misstep.
A misstep. So all of these things are things where in the situation, something is wrong. And also, they all seem to imply that you have had an active role in making it so. You didn't fall. You took a misstep, right? There's something, you have an active role in that.
Even a miscarriage of justice is something purposely done
right.
Wrong.
So here we are, and we have between 750,000 to 1 million women a year going through this natural physical process. And we're using a term that I believe implies some agency, some cause by women. So that's when I realized I hate this term. Why are we calling it that? And the clinical term is very clinical. It's spontaneous abortion. But one of the terms that I encountered, which to makes the most sense to me because I think it's just what it is, it's pregnancy loss. You were pregnant and you lost that pregnancy and now you're not pregnant anymore.
Do you think the idea of a miscarriage, something done wrong, leads us away from what you said, the natural – it's a very natural occurrence. It's not as if every pregnancy comes to term.
Right.
So is – Do you think it's a wrong-headed way to look at what in actuality happens a
yes.
lot?
Yes. I think it shapes the conversation and steers women towards feeling ashamed, feeling guilty, maybe feeling embarrassed. And then you go into a place of silence, really. So one of the studies that I cited in my article talks about how this is a natural process. We know that the majority of miscarriages are caused by chromosomal abnormalities. So the body detects and understands that for whatever reason, this pregnancy cannot be carried to term and ends it. But what we find in this study is that 40% of women believe that they may have done something to cause their miscarriage. 47% of women expressed feeling guilty. Those are high numbers. To me, it's directly related to how we do not speak about miscarriage or how we frame miscarriage.
Angela, you have lost two pregnancies, but you wrote that you were more affected by your second one. What mm-hmm. happened then?
Well, my first miscarriage happened in 2008, and it was a completely unplanned pregnancy. And I was discussing, you know, what are we going to do with my partner, who is now my husband? And it wasn't something that we felt was going to work out well for us if we were going to have this baby. But before I had to make a decision about what to do, I miscarried. So I felt actually a tremendous sense of relief. It seemed like my body on some level had made an executive decision, and I was just going to go along with that.
And that relief is something we often don't talk about.
Yeah, we don't talk about that at all. But I've since heard from women who have felt similarly. But 5 years later, a lot in my life was different. We were married. We had just bought a house. We, after years of ambivalence, had decided that we wanted to have a child. So when I miscarried then, it was devastating. There were a lot of hopes. There was a lot of love. There was a lot of excitement that was involved in that pregnancy. And to lose that really felt like it wasn't just something that was happening. It was something that I was losing. There was a part of my life that was going away.
How did your doctor talk with you about it?
My doctor talked about it very straightforwardly. He left room for me to say how was I feeling. But he also told me, you know, that this is normal and I wouldn't consider you abnormal unless this happened to you three times in a row. And that was it. I mean, I felt that he handled it well, but there wasn't much of an invitation to have a deeper conversation about it. And really, I think, I don't know that we're always as honest with our doctors as we would like to be. And I remember sort of trying to hold it together. And I wanted to seem like, right, I understand that this is normal. Of course, I'm being very rational about this. But inside, you know, in my mind, in my heart, my body, it's just, you know, it's screaming that none of this is fair. None of it makes sense. I don't understand. And the truth is, I think that's where we have a break, because you want to seem together. You want to be rational about it. But there's so much involved in a reaction that seems at odds with that.
Angela Garbez wrote about her experience in a piece in The Stranger called What I Gained from Having a Miscarriage. and we've tweeted out a link to that at KUOW. Now, somebody who knows a lot about this subject is Professor Kristen Swanson, the Dean of the College of Nursing at Seattle University. She has studied this problem that Angela described, the disconnect between how motherhood is talked about clinically and how it's talked about by women who are going through miscarriage or pregnancy loss. Dr. Swanson told me it's hard for doctors to talk about, but it's getting better.
When a miscarriage happens, I believe now that we are much more aware as a society, and that includes medical care, obstetrical care providers, be they physicians or midwives. There is a greater awareness now about this is a profound event. We are starting to get more and more research done on how do you prepare people for what lies ahead now that you have miscarried.
How should we approach miscarriage with the would-be mom?
I think the way that you approach it is it comes down to simply caring. First of all, you try to understand the event as it has meaning in the woman's life. So use your empathy at the time of miscarriage to watch how she's responding. There's tears, there's sadness. The next thing you do is be emotionally present to her. You meet her where she is. You let her know that her feelings matter to you. You do things for her that she would do for herself if it were at all possible. Provide her with books, with information, with validation. And at the very core of it, you convey your belief in this woman and her capacity to come through. You need to know that you will experience a grief response. For some of you, the grief response will be the, what the heck just happened? For others, it'll be, how could this be? How could this happen to me? But you're going through a transition, and transitions yield this grief response, this desire to make life go back to the way I thought it was supposed to be, not the way it's turning out.
You've talked about understanding and accepting that within a woman there is birth and life and death.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, in the context of childbearing loss, you have in your body both had this moment of carrying life. You've had this moment of passing that life, birth, if you will. We call it miscarriage when it happens early, but your body still is passing life. And it so happens with a miscarriage, it's death at the same time. Stillborn, it's the same, it's the similar experience. In the midst of birth, experienced death. It's profound. A woman's body gets on a routine every month. We build up a lining, we drop an egg, there's no sperm, we clean the lining, we're done, we have a period, we start all over again. This is month after month after month. But when there is that moment in time when the egg and sperm meet, the body suddenly goes, whoa, wait a minute, whole different game going on here. Hold on to that uterine lining. We got a pregnancy. We got to go. Hormones start releasing. Get the breasts ready. Get everything ready. And then a miscarriage happens, and the body has to get a quick jolt of, okay, stop. We're going back to the old production line again. And when you think of all of those, I'm giving it in a very playful way, but if you think about all of the hormonal shifts that have to happen so rapidly in a body to go from changing the mechanisms to hold on to life to change it and let go of life now, it's a very challenging physical experience for a woman to go through. And many women labor quite strongly in the midst of passing a pregnancy through a miscarriage.
One in five pregnancies. Why is miscarriage so foreign to some of us?
Is it an inability to talk about death? Is it an inability to talk about loss? Is it our inability to sit peacefully and intimately in front of another human being talking about their loss? Is it a larger issue we have of not knowing how to be present when somebody else is suffering? It's a topic that I think we're a little too quick to go to our own narrative. Oh, well, it was only 12 weeks. Could have been worse. It could have been later. You could have, you know, it could have been a child. It could have been, and we go to all of these attributions about why it could have been worse. And what I have discovered is those conversations are very good conversation stoppers. What it very quickly does is it'll say to the person who is sad, you know what, your sadness is a little more than I can handle, so I'm going to make a dismissive statement and we're done.
What would you love to say came out of the work that you've been doing around miscarriage?
Well, the things that I hope would be takeaway messages for people are, when you know someone who has miscarried, you know, take cues from the person who's sitting in front of you. They share that they've had a miscarriage. Answer with, wow, how was that for you? Answer with something that says, I'm ready for more conversation. Somebody's crying and say they miscarry. You know, very easy response is, I'm so sorry. That must have been hard to go through. How many women say, I'm never going to tell anybody in my next pregnancy I'm pregnant? And I will often say to them, you know, that's your choice. But the good news is, when you tell people you love that you're pregnant, they get to enjoy that with you. If you lose it, they get to be there with you during the loss. So maybe you want to choose wisely who you share it with. Those who can handle both your joy and your sadness, they're the ones to share the news with.
That was Professor Kristen Swanson. She is the dean of the College of Nursing at Seattle University. If you or somebody you know has had a miscarriage and you are talking about it, then share your story with us at record@kuow.org. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle, news and information. Laziness is a tough habit to break, but it does help if you have a bicycle. At least it did for one Seattle teenager. Radioactive's Melissa Takai has that.
Meet Diana Nguyen. She's 17 years young, she's a proud Asian American, and she can't go anywhere without her best friend.
Her name is Gertrude. My bike's name is Gertrude. This is Gertrude.
Yeah. She doesn't take anything seriously either, which used to be an actual problem for her. In middle school, Diana had a history of quitting things easily.
Laziness affected my life. I would say laziness ruled my life. It was just me looking at it and thinking about it and saying, oh, I wish I could have done this, or I wish I could do this, but never really taking the initiative to do anything.
When high school started, Diana had enough of laziness. It prevented her from doing the things she wanted to do. So when her friends told her that their bike club was looking for new members, she gave it a shot. Although she didn't have much experience in sports, biking didn't seem that hard. But when Diana had to ride from White Center to Alki, reality hit her.
I haven't exercised in like 3 years, and all of a sudden I'm on a bike, rushing down a hill, going up the hill. Not knowing how to change gears on my bike was one of the worst parts of it.
Not to mention that the sun was shining, her legs couldn't keep up the pace, and her energy level was just depleting. It was so bad that Diana found herself on the ground with her bike leader asking if she could see anything. At that moment, Diana realized that she pedaled into something completely outside of her comfort zone. But she couldn't just give up.
I've quit many things before, and that was something I didn't really like about myself. And I was very set on making this the one thing I didn't quit, because I was thinking, if my friends can do it, if they could be that fast and ride that smoothly, why couldn't I do it either?
2 months later, Diana did her first official ride called Red Bell. It's 100 miles from Redmond to Bellingham.
And it was a bike ride where I was like, oh man, this is serious. People have two water bottles instead of one. And we found our bikes, we had our numbers, which was really cool because I've never had an experience where I had a number pinned onto my bag.
Unlike her first ride to Alki, this one had a time limit. Although Diana did train, she wasn't prepared to ride the great distance. The pressure was on, but the biking conditions kept her at ease.
Just sometimes when we got into the more closed and quiet roads, it was just wind on leaves, and it was very relaxing, and the sound of our gears. And it was very nice because it wasn't an uncomfortable silence between everyone who was riding. It was just everyone appreciating the nature around.
But let's not forget that Red Bell is 100 miles long. When the sky grew dark and bikers zoomed on by, Diana knew that the race was ending. With 18 miles to go, it'd be impossible to finish it all in time. So, she got into one of the support vehicles and drove to the finish line. Although Diana was disappointed, she looked on the bright side.
I thought, wow, I was able to go like 82 miles. If I had more time, I would have been able to really finish it. And with that thought in mind, it was just like, I don't even care if I fail or I succeed, but just the action of doing it makes me feel accomplished.
1 year later, Diana tackled 200 miles from Seattle to Portland in only 2 days. It was a tough ride having to deal with thousands of bikers and angry drivers in traffic, but she finally crossed the finish line.
I just thought that if I could do Red Bell, I could do this too. And after I could do this, I could do anything else.
No passing out, no support vehicles, nothing. It was just her and her determination to go the extra mile. And this attitude went beyond her biking career. Instead of getting picked up from school, her mom now drops her off with Gertrude so she can ride back home. But some days, she may bike to downtown Seattle with friends, or head to wrestling practice to prepare for her next match. The choices are endless for Diana, and it keeps her busy, but happy. If she didn't take the risk of joining bike club, none of this would have ever happened.
It's so cliche, I'm cringing, but just do the things that you want to do. And if you don't know what you're doing with your life, just start small at first. Even if you're not very sure on if you like it or not, it's better to start it and try it out before you just don't try it at all and regret. And so, yeah, that's all.
For Radioactive, it's Melissa Takai.
Melissa created that story in KUOW's Radioactive Youth Media Workshop at the Seattle Public Library. You can connect with Radioactive on Facebook. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information, catching you up on the news. If you bought a Volkswagen and thought you were doing the green thing, well, you already know you got ripped off.
Volkswagen turned over 500,000 American drivers into unwitting accomplices in an unprecedented assault on our country's environment.
That is Assistant Attorney General Sally Yates announcing a settlement today. Volkswagen has agreed to pay nearly $15 billion for its scam to defraud consumers and cheat federal emission standards. VW sold 22,000 cars here in Washington State, and today State Attorney General Bob Ferguson announced the company will pay Washington $24 million as part of the settlement. It's KUOW Seattle. Author Chuck Klosterman argues there is a problem with understanding history. The people who decide what a certain era means are not the people who experienced it, which would seem to warp our understanding. His book is called But What If We're Wrong? Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past. Klosterman says future people are going to reinterpret our time now to explain what they want the past to be. He wonders if everything we think is important and relevant now is going to become meaningless.
Well, like when I talk about rock music, for example, what I'm basically saying is that it feels like rock is receding from the culture. Okay, and that doesn't mean it's going to become extinct, but it's going to move out of the center of the culture where it was for like the last half of the 20th century. Now, if that continues to occur in, say, 200 years, rock music will be essentially an academic pursuit. It'll be something that people will have to be taught to understand and feel. It won't just be part of life. So it'll be sort of like marching music, right? Now, when we talk about marching music now, everyone knows who it is. But if we go on the street and ask someone to name a composer, they'll either name no one or one person, John Philip Sousa. He is now interchangeable with marching music. He is the idea. So apply this to rock. If we get to a point where rock music is an academic pursuit, it will probably be explained through the identity of one artist. Okay, so who will that artist be? Well, my natural inclination, and in a rational world, the answer is the Beatles.
But maybe Elvis.
But we don't live in the rational world. Uh-huh. Yes. Uh-huh. So you have to think, well, what are other ways this could unspool? What are ways that someone could become the definition of rock music outside of just the idea of merit? Because merit is not the answer to these questions.
You use examples from science, metaphysics, and pop culture, examples of things we know are true. We understand gravity. Our lives are really happening right now. The U.S. Constitution is good for us. Football is too violent, on and on. And you show how we could be wrong. Why does it matter that we could be wrong?
Well, I mean, that is a difficult question to answer because does it matter? Okay. Does it matter that our, say, our view of the 1400s, let's say we're totally wrong about how we view that period of time. What is the consequence of that? Well, in some ways, the answer is none. Okay, there's no utility to this book. If even if I'm correct about the way we may misinterpret the present and that people in 500 years will remember this time differently, it won't really impact our lives now. And the fact that they may misinterpret or confuse what this time was like won't really even damage them. Okay, in a way, the future is a neutral charge. It will be different. But it doesn't really matter if we're right or wrong about it. The certitude we have about reality is almost certainly going to be wrong because the history of ideas is the history of people being wrong.
Here's an example that's not in your book, but your book reminded me of, first of all, how wrong a lot of people have been about Donald Trump. How do you view him with your, you know, your open-mindedness about your own opinions?
Well, okay, you look at the trajectory of his political experience here. We were constantly saying this is not going to work. You know, I remember talking to people way back at last Thanksgiving. It's like, you know, at what point will he no longer lead the GOP polls even? The idea of him winning the nomination didn't even seem plausible. So it was just sort of this is impossible. It's not going to work. It's not going to work. It's not going to work. Then suddenly he is the nominee. And a lot of the same people who were talking about how this was impossible immediately hit the panic button. And they're like, this is going to destroy democracy. Now, that said, I don't know if it's mathematically possible for him to win this election. It doesn't appear that it is. But let's say that he does. I do think it's possible that Trump might just be a bad president in the traditional way presidents are bad. Like, it might not be this cataclysmic thing. He might be so ineffective that it's almost not damaging. It's a strange thing. That's almost an optimistic view to hold.
You left me with an interesting idea. Basically, you said storytelling is everything and storytelling is the problem.
Yes.
What could I do with that?
Well, pretty much all of Western society is built around this idea that we understand information through narrative, okay, where it's built into our mind as children through where we're kind of relayed stories. But there's also evidence that biologically that's just how our brain works, that the way we are as a mammal is set up to understand the world through the rudimentary style of storytelling, that there usually is a character and that the character has conflict and that this conflict plays out in a way with a resolution, all of these things. It's how we understand news. It's how we understand history. But in a sense, that is at odds with reality, because reality doesn't necessarily work in that kind of linear structured function. So we're constantly understanding the world through the idea of this is how the story kind of unspools itself, but the world isn't really a story like that. It involves ancillary, unconnected things that sort of contradict the logic of the story. So we're forcing the logic upon it. I mean, maybe that's the easiest way to describe it. Storytelling forces people to jam logic into situations where logic does not exist. Here's another way to describe it, okay? In this book, I talk about Moby Dick, okay? Very early in the book, I discuss how, and that was one of the reasons I got interested in writing this book at all. I was reading about Moby Dick. I have to admit, I wasn't reading Moby Dick, but I was reading about it.
That's a lot of us.
Yeah. So Herman Melville writes Moby Dick and he thinks, this is my masterwork. This is like my, you know, this is what I've built my whole career toward. He was a successful commercial author, but, you know, not famous. The book comes out, gets mixed reviews, doesn't sell that well, ruins his career. He becomes an alcoholic, dies. Okay. Many years later, after World War I, he's been dead for a long time. The book is rediscovered. And it's not just rediscovered to be like, oh, this is a good book. It's like the book. This is the great American novel. If you're an American novelist, this is your aspiration. So we have to explain why that happened. Okay. So the explanation becomes, well, okay, a lot of guys were coming back from World War I, and they were fighting this amorphous, faceless German enemy. It's kind of like fighting a faceless, you know, anonymous whale. And there was a brotherhood among soldiers, much like there's a brotherhood among guys on a whaling ship. And, you know, Moby Dick has these long passages with, like, arcane knowledge, how to make rope and all these things. Very much like if you go to war, you have to learn how to operate your rifle, learn all these obscure kind of facts that are dependent on your life. These are the reasons, they would argue, that this book was suddenly seen as real important. It resonated with those people. And yet, there are many books that could have fulfilled this role. This is the one we just sort of capriciously or arbitrarily selected. That doesn't mean it's not great. It is great, but it didn't have to be this book. It just worked out that way. But we have to reverse engineer that explanation. Okay? We have to apply reasonable storytelling and logic to how this got selected, because it's very difficult to admit it just got selected. And the main thing that makes something popular is a degree of pre-existing popularity. It perpetuates itself. But we don't want to think about the world like that. Like, it's awkward to think that chance is the main reason history comes as it is. But that's what it is.
So if we're storytelling animals and the story basically can't match reality, it sounds like we are condemned to be wrong.
We are. I mean, every generation of people is, to a degree, condemned to be wrong. Like, it's always going to be that way because we're making up reality as we go, which means we can also make up the past. Somebody once said, it was actually Joe Walsh of the Eagles who said this. He was like, well, you know, you look at your life and it seems totally chaotic. And just it's happening by chance. But you look back on your life, it seems like a perfectly knit novel. Well, we're doing that all the time with everything. We're looking back and then deciding it makes sense. And people are going to do that to us too. Like, someone in the future will look back at Trump and they will give a real reasonable explanation to as how this happened. And yet there is no reasonable explanation to how this happened. There are just lots of interesting guesses.
With lots of interesting guesses, there's Chuck Klosterman with his new book, But What If We're Wrong, Thinking About the Present as If It Were the Past? I asked him how the world would change if we all read his book and believed him, and he said the result would be more humility and wonder. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle.
It's a minute past 1 o'clock. News update from the BBC just seconds away. This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information.